If it please the court, my name is Craig Johnson. I represent the appellant Jamie Avery. I intend to concentrate my argument on point one, which is the reason that the court granted transfer in this case, whether or not there was substantial evidence of intoxication in order to warrant an instruction pattern under MAI CR 310.50, which is the instruction that is based on section 562.076. As with any instructions, the jury instructions must be supported by substantial evidence in order to give the instruction. And section 562.076.3 specifically says in order to get an instruction on voluntary intoxication, there has to be evidence that the defendant was voluntarily intoxicated. It was in a voluntarily intoxicated condition. And is our contention, and I think the record supports, that there was no evidence that Ms. Avery was in an involuntary intoxicated condition. There is no definition listed under 562.076 as to what intoxicated condition means, nor is there any guidance really as under the relevant MAI. But this court, since 1927, has defined intoxicated condition as in the Reichstag case as an impaired condition of thought or action and the loss of the normal controls of one's faculties as a result of drinking alcohol.
Am I correct in recalling that there were 8 to 11 beers during 7 hours? Is that the evidence?
That's correct.
And really just that?
In one mixed drink.
Excuse me?
Was there also one mixed drink?
I disagree that there was a mixed drink. I don't think there was any evidence to support that there was a mixed drink. Ms. Avery testified that there were about 8 beers. Ms. Buckner testified that, I believe a fair inference of her testimony is that Mrs. Avery had 7 to 10. She wasn't sure, 7 to 10 beers. The mixed drink comes in that Ms. Buckner testified she was drinking mixed drinks all night. Purchased some at the bar, later on, and drank some mixed drink at the residence of Miss Avery. The respondent wants to argue that because there were 3 glasses later seized, that Miss Avery must have been drinking mixed drink, but there was absolutely no evidence that Mrs. Avery drank from those glasses or that there was, in fact, any alcohol in all 3 of the glasses.
Why isn't the evidence of the number of beers enough to consist of evidence of intoxication such that the jury might wonder whether or not she was intoxicated, and so the state was justified in asking for the instruction?
Well, I don't think that the number of beers under the circumstances and under the time period would be enough to warrant a reasonable inference of intoxication. In other words, that she had an impaired thought or action.
How about when it's combined with there was at least some evidence of her demeanor and her yelling and being very upset and making certain threatening statements and so forth. When that behavior is combined with the drinking, does that not make it relevant?
But I think the behavior was more designed towards her being upset that he was in town after certain problems had developed, including threatening phone calls by him. There were a waitress testified, a bartender testified, Ms. Buckner testified, several officers testified. Not a single witness testified that she was intoxicated, or they believed she was intoxicated, or that she acted impaired whatsoever. And so I don't believe that the fact that she was upset that Mr. Paris was in town after some earlier problems would warrant a fair inference that she was intoxicated.
Don't we go along with the jury? We let the jury decide this. As you said, there's no definition, or it's a loose definition of losing control of one's faculties. And there's no scientific data that's required, for example, blood tests. Can't the jury infer from the evidence of the number of beers, the amount of time, what it means?
I under the facts of this case, I don't believe so. First of all, it's the court has to make the initial determination as to whether or not the instruction should be given. In other words, the court has to determine, is there substantial evidence of intoxication in order to give this instruction. The jury's actually never actually asked to determine one way or the other whether or not she's intoxicated. It's the court's duty to look at the evidence and decide whether or not the instruction should be given.
What are the notes on use for 310.50 say about who can request it?
I believe it can. I believe it can be given by the. Well, I don't know that it necessarily says who can request it, but certainly, in fact, the current notes on use, they don't say who can request it, but normally it would be an instruction requested by the state and not the defense, because it really doesn't assist or aid the defense. And it's not a mandatory instruction, so it normally wouldn't be the court's duty. So it'd be normally the state that would request the instruction.
But don't the notes on use say that only evidence of intoxication, not impairment, is required in compliance with our decision in State versus Osley? Why shouldn't we follow that decision?
The notes on use actually are silent. They don't really say. It doesn't say anything. An earlier notes on use back a while, several revisions back, did mention the word impairment. And then the notes on use were modified, in which it said if there are relevant evidence of an intoxicated condition, this instruction can be given. And now they say nothing.
Why shouldn't we follow our decision in State versus Osley?
Well, Owsley, I don't think, in Owsley, this court found that there was evidence of an intoxicated condition. But there, you were talking about 1.5 pints of gin, which would basically be 24 one-ounce shots of gin. And that's a far greater amount of alcohol than we've got here.
Are you saying intoxication inherently means impairment?
What
does it mean?
This court has defined it in that manner. For instance, in the Rystek case, they have said everybody. We don't even need to define intoxicated condition because everybody knows that it's an impaired condition. It's an impaired condition or action of the defendant caused by alcohol. And when talking about what under the influence means in a driving while intoxicated case, this court in Cox said, well, under the influence means when the defendant's driving abilities are impaired. And so this court has always...
So you have to be legally intoxicated above the 0.08 in order to, in effect, qualify for that instruction?
No, I don't think so, but there has to be some evidence of intoxication, which this court has defined as an impairment of condition or action. And we don't have it here. And while there are a number of beers drank, I would note that as far as the timing goes, at least from the 4.5 hours preceding the shooting, there was only clear evidence of one beer, and that was actually speculated by Ms. Buckner that she seemed to recall while they were driving around, Ms. Avery had one beer. And in Ms. Avery's statement, she said, I took my one open beer into the house without indicating as to how much she had drunk or any of that, or whether or not that was in fact the same beer Ms. Buckner had referred to. And so that's a long period of time where we have a very minimum amount of alcohol consumption right preceding it. And again, I would note that none of the officers testified. And they dealt with her several times and on a face-to-face basis. None of the officers testified as to any impairment. And none of them speculated that she was in an intoxicated condition. So I don't believe that there's any evidence which a reasonable juror could find that she was intoxicated. And I think that the court at least needs to have that evidence in order to get the instruction. And having said that, I believe that the giving of the instruction would prejudice Ms. Avery's defense. And that this court should follow the cases that have found likewise that when there is no evidence to support that the defendant is in an intoxicated condition, especially in a case like a self-defense case, that the defendant can be prejudiced. Because in essence, what the jury is hearing is that the court at least believes that the defendant's intoxicated, because the jury is instructed in determining the defendant's guilt, this defendant, not just anybody, in determining this defendant's guilt or innocence, you are instructed that an intoxicated condition won't relieve her responsibility. Well, implied in that is that there is evidence that she's intoxicated. Otherwise, why would the instruction be given in the first place? If the court didn't believe she was intoxicated, the jury wouldn't be instructed upon it. I think a jury would reach the conclusion that they wouldn't be instructed upon something that wasn't an issue in the case, that there was no evidence to support.
What's our standard of review of the judge?
Excuse me?
What's our standard of review?
I think it's a clearly erroneous standard, because if there's sufficient evidence to give it, then the instruction must be given, and if there's not, then it shouldn't be given. And I believe that under the facts of this case, when there is absolutely no evidence at all of any impairment, of any intoxicated condition, depending on how you want to define that term.
Well, there may be evidence, if you just say it's not substantial evidence. I mean, there's beers being drunk and it's all this, that's kind of like evidence, and you're saying it's not substantial.
Well, there's evidence of consumption, but not intoxication. I mean, I can consume beer, but that doesn't mean I'm intoxicated.
Are we reviewing a ruling that is a question of law or a question of fact? Is the issue of whether there's substantial evidence a legal issue?
I think it is a legal issue. I mean, the court, I mean, ultimately it's based upon facts. You have to review the facts of the case, but I think that ultimately this court determines whether or not there's substantial evidence or whether there's a reasonable inference that the defendant was intoxicated.
I mean, I assume that the purpose of the instruction, when it's not raised as a defense or raised in any sort of way, the jury has heard evidence that there were 8 beers or whatever, is to keep them, when they're back in the jury room, from saying, well, having somebody say, well, you know, she was drunk, you know, it's not her fault. So it's to give them the legal standard by which to, so the question I suppose is, and maybe your burden is a little bit different, that is to show that not only was there not evidence of intoxication, but there wasn't evidence of much drinking. Of course there was.
I mean, there was evidence of drinking, but there was no evidence of intoxication. And when you're given an instruction that's not based upon the evidence, and that's not really an issue in the case, I think it has a tendency to mislead or confuse the jury.
But since there's no scientific evidence here, it's not like a DWI, there's no scientific evidence, it's almost whose seat of the pants opinion of intoxication do you take? The jurors, the judges first, and then it's the jurors or the appellate court? I mean, how does anyone make a determination if there really isn't any science to this at all?
No, but witnesses could testify. I mean, in the cases that are cited by both briefs, there are times to where witnesses say the person was acting kind of crazy and they were driving reckless or whatever. And so oftentimes witnesses will testify as to acts that you can reasonably infer intoxication from.
Thank you, counsel.
Or appearance of the party.
Correct.
Thank you.
May it please the court. Sean McElprang for the state of Missouri. I think the first question that the court should consider is how much alcohol was consumed in this case. And there's been some disagreement over how much alcohol was consumed. But it appears from the record, if you look at the testimony of Ms. Buckner, that from 4 o'clock in the afternoon until 9 o'clock, that the defendant in this case drank 4 to 6 beers at the bar, and then had another mixed drink at the home. And I think it's reasonable to infer that they both drank when they were at the home. The defendant invited her to her home for another drink. They went to the home. But later, there were 3 glasses found with the items that were used to make the mixed drinks. I'm not saying that she must have necessarily had a mixed drink, but it sure is a reasonable inference that she had a mixed drink, that two friends would go back to her home and have drinks together.
Isn't it a reality that different people can drink different amounts of alcohol and one be intoxicated and the other not? So simply having evidence of the amount consumed over a period of time does not get you to a reasonable inference that this particular person was intoxicated without evidence of the indicia of intoxication.
Well, Your Honor, I would agree to a certain extent that under some circumstances that might not be enough to infer intoxication beyond a reasonable doubt. For example, if this were a driving while intoxicated case and the state had the burden of proving intoxication beyond a reasonable doubt, there might be a level of inference or a degree of evidence greater than what I'm talking about here that would be necessary before a conviction could be sustained. But what we're talking about in this case is whether an instruction should be given. And ordinarily, an instruction should be given on substantial evidence. And that's not the same thing as evidence proving a fact beyond a reasonable doubt. The defendant cites the Whalen case and says, well, you can't give the state the luxury of forced inferences or anything like that. But the Whalen case, when it was talking about that standard of review for evidence, was examining the sufficiency of the evidence. The sufficiency of evidence for the state to prove something beyond a reasonable doubt. Here, it was not necessary for the state to prove this beyond a reasonable doubt. It was only necessary for the judge, as an initial sort of threshold gatekeeper, to ask, is there some evidence that would lead the jury to believe that this defendant was intoxicated? I think, as Judge Wolf pointed out, this instruction is designed to give the jury the legal guidance they need on how to consider this evidence, if, in fact, they think that there's evidence of intoxication. And the threshold for giving it should be quite low. And in all other circumstances, when an instruction is given, the court questions and says, viewing the evidence in the light most favorable to giving this instruction, do we think this instruction should be given? In the self-defense arena, for example, and Ms. Avery has good knowledge of this because her first case was reversed because of a failure to give a self-defense instruction. In the self-defense arena, the court says, is there substantial evidence? And what does that mean? Well, it means any evidence, however implausible, that there was self-defense or a possibility of self-defense. Do we give the instruction? And the answer that the court has consistently reached is yes. We give the instruction, and then we let the jury make whatever relevant findings are necessary.
And following up on Judge Breckenridge's question, don't we give the trial court some deference because it's proven that women versus men could consume different amounts of alcohol before being intoxicated, women presumably consuming less amounts, the size of the frame of the person's body, maybe their age, and isn't the trial court who observes the demeanor of the defendant in the courtroom in a better position to make that judgment call than us here on review?
In some respects, I think that's correct. If the record was completely silent, for example, on the issue of how large the defendant was and those kinds of things, it might be important to defer to the trial court in that situation because the trial court would be able to see the defendant and try and gauge how a jury would also see the defendant and then make a determination whether there's a possibility those jurors are thinking this particular defendant, due to her size, might be more susceptible to alcohol. In this case, I think we know that she was shorter than 5'10". I think that was mentioned at one point. At least I recall that in closing argument. The prosecutor made a couple of arguments referring to the defendant's size. I think he referred to her as a attractive young woman who was shorter than the victim, who was 5'10". And so we're dealing with a person who is smaller than I am, for example. And I'm not exactly a very tall person, but I'm a little bit wide. We're dealing with a person.
Nothing wrong with that.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you. I appreciate that. And but we're dealing with a situation where the jury can see this person, but there's also some evidence as to the size of this person. And, you know, people out there in the community, there wasn't any scientific evidence in this case, for example, about the rate of metabolism, those kinds of things, about how quickly alcohol is taken into the blood system and how quickly it can affect the body. So what we're left with is a situation where the jury isn't given specific scientific guidance on that, but a situation where the jury knows this particular defendant has consumed a great number of alcoholic beverages in the 5 yards. Yes?
I would just say that the defense in the brief, if not an argument, relied on the fact that all the evidence of intoxication or consumption of alcohol came from the state. And so, in effect, the state introduced it and then said, oh, it might confuse the jury, so we have to tell them not to consider it. And so this is a different situation than if the defense had introduced that evidence.
And I think if the defense were the party that were introducing evidence of alcohol consumption, that would be an easier case. That would be a case where it's obvious that the instruction needs to be given because that would present a situation where the defense is affirmatively relying on the condition to try and exculpate him or herself.
But isn't the law regarding instructions, regardless of who introduces evidence or what their theory of the case is, that the bottom line on jury instructions is it a correct statement of law and is it supported by evidence?
Yes, that's correct. And I'll go
and
back.
And if that's right, why does it matter who brought the evidence in?
I think it doesn't matter. And I refer back to the self-defense situation again, where if self-defense is submitted, it doesn't have to be evidence submitted by the defendant. But if
well,
it comes
bad,
in...
bad faith would not be. I mean, you should not that I'm suggesting that was the case here. But if there were evidence the state introduced it and it was completely irrelevant, solely to get that,
that might present a situation where the court could say we don't think the state should be able to do that. But evidence of alcohol consumption can be relevant as to conduct, as Section 562.076 says. It is admissible on the issue of conduct, but it can't be used to negate a mental state.
So how is it relevant here? For what purpose was it?
Well, and I think it's relevant here because I think most people understand, and I think it's a matter of common knowledge, that alcohol consumption can lower someone's inhibitions. It can also change how people view and perceive situations. And the defendant's perceptions in this case were important, especially in as much as she was claiming self-defense. I mean, I think it could actually, this evidence could be beneficial one way or the other, I think, in terms of her perceptions. But the state, I think, in closing argument said, well, maybe I should just read it. She said, then she's not there, referring to the defendant. She's not at her home. So Ms. Buckner goes to the Hickory House, the next likely spot, and there she is at the Hickory House drinking. She told Gina that she had at least four beers by the time that Gina got there, and she had several others afterwards. And now, keep in mind that also back then, on that day, back in October, she had been drinking that day, too, referring to the time when she had been very upset at the victim. So she's in the same frame of mind. And when Bruce is mentioned, the victim, she regains all that anger that she expressed that day in front of Bruce and Michelle. So it bears upon her conduct. It bears upon the way that she's going to respond to the situation. It perhaps lowers her inhibitions and puts her in a state of mind where she's willing to engage in the acts that the state has accused her of committing. In this case, it was first-degree murder. Of course, originally it was first-degree murder. It was second-degree murder in this retrial. But, of course, the jury found it was voluntary manslaughter. And so, one would even think that the voluntary manslaughter verdict might have been helped by the idea that she was intoxicated and thus perhaps more ready to become inflamed by her passions. But be that as it may, the evidence in this case was relevant for various purposes. And, of course, the defendant never objected to the evidence and never said it wasn't relevant. And so what we're left with is a situation not where the court should necessarily determine the relevance of the evidence, but where the claim raised by this defendant is whether this instruction was supported by the evidence.
If we accept your argument for all future cases, then if intoxication is not proven by the indicia of intoxication and is simply the consumption of alcohol with no scientific proof as to whether that's enough or not, doesn't that then take away kind of a workable standard and replace it with who knows? I mean, aren't you asking us to impose a standard that's totally based on speculation?
Well, in fact, I think that it wouldn't necessarily be harmful to craft a rule that says even if there's evidence from which a jury might speculate that the defendant is intoxicated, this instruction should be given, because even if they're speculating, even if it's not based on, evidence beyond a reasonable doubt or some lesser standard by preponderance, even if the jury is thinking at some level, well, she might have been intoxicated, that juror needs to know that
but that's not what the current instruction says.
Well, except that the current instruction just refers to intoxication. So if in the juror's mind, the juror is speculating that the defendant is in fact intoxicated, but it's speculation that isn't based on substantial evidence.
But all the case law to this point is either you have the presumption of alcohol in criminal cases based on a certain blood alcohol level, or you have indicia of intoxication. And so aren't you asking then for the first time to change what can be utilized to prove intoxication from indicia of intoxication to a consumption of amount of alcohol? And maybe not the first time because of the, what was the other case, the Osley case, but where that was such a significant amount of alcohol.
Well, I don't think I'm really asking the court to change much of anything, because with regard to the submission of this instruction, I don't think the court has ever made a pronouncement that any degree or quantum of evidence is necessary to support its submission. Now, there have been other cases in other, in the Court of Appeals, for example, older cases, the James and Kenner case, which were decided when the when the note on use specifically required evidence of impairment. But the with regard to this particular situation, I don't think the court has ever said, this court has ever said, there must be a certain quantum or degree of intoxication. And in fact, if you look at the Taylor case, and I understand that that's a case where the defendant affirmatively relied on intoxication to exculpate himself. The only evidence of intoxication in that case was the defendant saying in his confession, well, we were riding around and drinking a little, something along those lines.
Unless, I mean, we're dealing with the real world. Unless you have a doctor come in and say, this is the indicia of alcoholism. I mean, we're just dealing with people in their normal lives. And plus, at a bar, they don't have a breathalyzer. Maybe they should. But there aren't any breathalyzers at bars. It's just senior pants. I mean, basically, but who's better, who can do it better than the jury and the judge who's got to say, well, there's some evidence. Well, like you said before, some evidence and substantial evidence would be some difference, but I'm not sure there is.
I'm not sure that our case law has really drawn a distinction between substantial evidence and some evidence when it comes to submitting an instruction. Because submitting an instruction has really always had a low threshold of evidence. And really, when you get to the purpose, the underlying purpose of this instruction, if a juror is sitting there thinking, well, I think the person was intoxicated, even if the evidence is very slim, and even if this speculation or thought is only based on the slimmest degree of evidence, Missouri law says that evidence of intoxication cannot be used to negate a mental state. And that's really the whole purpose of this instruction.
Right. It's to keep the jury from being confused by something they heard during the trial.
Right. Right.
And so the question, I suppose, is directed first to the trial judge's discretion. We normally don't think of jury instructions as discretionary, but Judge Sims is the one that heard what the evidence was, and it's his mind whether there's a possibility that the jurors in his community might be misled by that.
Well, also, you know, when looking at this situation, this is nothing more than a correct statement of what the law is, correct?
Correct.
This jury instruction makes no findings.
Right. It does not suggest that the defendant was, in fact, intoxicated. It is not a defense. As this court stated in Irvin, it's an evidentiary instruction. This court in Johnson also recently, in 2006, said, you know, because there was evidence of drug and alcohol consumption, this instruction needed to be there to assist the jury in their consideration of this evidence. That's all it is. And a liberal policy for submitting this instruction is warranted because otherwise, if you try and draw the line somewhere out, further out, where you say, well, there has to be enough intoxication in evidence of intoxication, but if it's too little, well, then no, don't give it. That leaves trial courts in a very tough position. How do they decide when to instruct?
But isn't on the other hand, one is left with the idea about whether or not giving the instruction, and I think this is your opponent's point, could mislead the jury into thinking that this is an issue that they have to decide, that this is something they have to think about. So, I mean, in that sense, the giving of the instruction might be misleading too, but it's kind of...
Might raise the idea of intoxication in their minds and then cause them to think about it. Is that what you're saying? Mm-hmm. I suppose that's possible. And of course, there is that possibility, I guess, in any case. But first of all, I don't think that the jury can really be... I don't think the defendant can be prejudiced by an accurate statement of the law. And the other thing, I guess, would be that to the extent that the defendant is taking issue with the form of this instruction, I don't think he challenged the form of this instruction at all at trial. And if he's trying to raise a plain error claim that the form of the instruction is wrong and that it should have said something, well, then perhaps that's something to consider. But I think he'd have to show a manifest injustice under those circumstances. And I guess the last point would just be that I can see a situation where this instruction could perhaps be drafted like some of those other instructions, which say something along the lines of, there has been evidence in this case of alcohol consumption, you know, and so it's one of the issues is whether the defendant was intoxicated. But keep in mind that if the defendant was intoxicated, it can't be used to negate him. Something along those lines could be drafted.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
First of all, I'd like to comment. Counsel said that you can't be prejudiced by a correct statement of the law, but actually in Irwin, the instruction there, the court said this is a correct statement of the law. But under the circumstances of this case, the defendant has been denied his right to due process. So just because it's maybe a correct statement of the law doesn't mean a defendant can't be prejudiced. For instance, like in the closing argument, if opposing counsel argues law is not an issue, even if the laws that they're arguing are correct, it doesn't mean that the defendant can't be prejudiced.
Let me ask you a question. Getting back to the questions that Judge Breckenridge raised, and also one of my learned colleagues said before at another point, some work is appellate work. Some work is trial judge work. Unless we're ready to draw some bright lines, the trial judge is the one that's seen all the evidence. The appellate court, doing the best they can, they didn't see any of the evidence. They saw nothing of the witnesses. And we have the same perspective. We haven't either. We can't put any tilt on the credibility of the witnesses or the quality of the testimony. We have no way of doing that. So maybe this is trial court work, not appellate work, and we can't really find some quote-unquote bright line to deal with it. And it's up to the, figuring out what's intoxicated or is up to the jury and up to the judge and then the jury.
But I think Section 562.076 does draw a bright line. It says when there is evidence that a person was voluntarily intoxicated. It doesn't say when there is evidence that the defendant has been drinking. It doesn't say.
I don't even know what intoxication is. Who is saying what is the criteria for intoxication? How do we know that scientifically, and how is that presented to the jury?
Well, we know what intoxication, but this court has said intoxication is clear, that even the layperson knows that intoxication is a compared condition or action. In other words, by drinking alcohol, that there's some impairment of condition or action. For instance, in this October incident, there was Mrs. Avery was stumbling around and she was throwing up, et cetera, et cetera. There was evidence of impairment back in October whenever she had this fight with Mr. Paris and she had been asked to leave. In stark contrast, there was no evidence at all of any impairment of action or act or deed or anything. And there were many a witness that the state could have asked that testified about her drinking, and not a single one testified about impairment.
But the state wasn't trying to prove she was impaired. So, I mean, that's the point, is they're saying it's not relevant to it. But she'd been drinking, and they were trying to draw an analogy to the earlier situation, but they were not saying she went so far as to be impaired.
Well, I think they were inferring that based upon their argument that she was in the exact state of mind at the time of the shooting as she was back in October. And in fact, the respondent in its brief argues says by that argument the state was saying that she was intoxicated.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
The case is submitted. When